It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, what do you get when you mix classical music with bluegrass? A Wisconsin band is finding out. We'll get a taste coming up. First, it's one thing to teach a child how to read. It's another to teach a child to love reading. We know that books can offer a world of benefits to children, but as any parent will tell you, it's not always easy to get kids to pick up and enjoy books on their own. That's where our next guest comes in. In a new book, she shares tips to help young readers develop a lifelong love of reading and how parents can help. Maria Russo is the children's books editor at the New York Times Book Review. She's co-author of the new book, How to Raise a Reader. Maria, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you spend most of your book on the how, and so will we. Let's talk about the why. What is in it for our kids if we instill this love of reading?
Well, reading is a lifelong pleasure, but also a lifelong tool that helps you succeed in all areas of life. So we want to raise kids who are readers, not just because it does help them academically, but also it helps them in all kinds of other more subtle ways, like executive function and empathy and becoming a good citizen. All of these things, it's just crucial for people to have a reading life that is full of pleasure and joy and sort of intrinsic motivation. That's what we're really talking about, is how do we get kids to want to read? How does it come from the kid himself or herself and not just because of pressure from the parents or the school?
Right. How do we draw that balancing act? We really want them to read, but we don't want to be pressuring them to read.
Right. Well, you know, I think it's something that has sort of crept into parenting culture now, this pressure to become the teacher, to be the one who teaches your kid how to read and who sort of prods them forward up the levels of reading. And we're saying, parents, please step back from that. Let your teachers be the ones who run a classroom. What you're doing at home is creating an environment where books are fun, books are pleasurable, books are a great way to pass the time. So, you know, one of the things you can do is read yourself. You know, let your child see you reading. You're modeling an adult who's choosing to read when, you know, let's face it, we all have a lot of other choices now. We have a lot of distractions. If you're someone who chooses to read, you're conveying that message to your child that, wow, reading is a great way to spend time. Reading is a great choice.
We're talking to Maria Russo, author of the new book, How to Raise a Reader, co-author of the book. She's New York Times Book Review's children's books editor. Maria, in your book, you take it a stage at a time from birth basically through the teenage years. Let's start with those little ones. As a parent, it did feel weird sometimes reading to a kid who you knew wasn't understanding a bit of it. It still pays off though, right?
It's true. I had that same experience. You know, I was 36 when my first child was born. You know, now I have three. And I was a little awkward talking to my baby. But all the research shows, you know, babies need to be exposed to language. They need to be exposed to a lot of different words. And the catch is that those words have to be live and in person. You can't just put your baby in front of the TV and think that those words count. So since you need to be exposing your baby to words, what a great way to do it. Read them stories, read them books. Because what you're also doing there is kind of creating these family rituals, creating these associations. You're holding your baby close and they're feeling that warm embrace. You know, that's all part of creating a good vibe around reading. So even though your baby's maybe not understanding all the words, you know, we still want to do it because they're hearing the cadences. They're getting exposed to the language. And, you know, they can see things. They have a visual reading going on, even when they're really little. You know, that's how the great picture books work. There's information in those pictures that is not in the words. So while you're reading the words to your kid is reading the pictures. You know, they're following the story through the pictures. And the great illustrators put stuff in the pictures that are not in the words. So your kid is going to see things. Lots of parents have this experience. You're reading a picture book to your kid, and they point something out that you didn't even see, you didn't even notice. So that's great. That's the design of picture books, and that's all helping them develop all of these different brain functions that just pay off in all kinds of ways.
What are some of your favorite books for that age, for that that newborn to toddler who doesn't even understand the words yet?
Oh, there's so many. Well, I really recommend board books for the really little ones, for the babies, especially when they're still at the age where they tear the pages. You know, we don't want that. We have this great option now of these chunky board books that You can eat them. You can throw them across the room. You know, they're adorable. And they're also designed for the baby's attention span. You know, and some of them, you have to remember, babies like to see their own world in a book. So lots of babies appreciate a book that's just full of different faces of babies. You know, you see those in the store, you're like, huh, it's just faces of babies. They love that. They love to see other babies. They love to see part, just the everyday objects in their life, you know, the stroller, the crib, the playground. You know, it might seem like, oh, they see that every day. No, they love it. They love to be able to say, oh, I was at the playground today, and here's a playground in my book. So really give your babies lots of stuff that is familiar, but also you can really read any book to a baby. You know, toddlers especially, their minds are open. They're absorbing. They're like sponges. You know, they want to take in the whole world, even if your kid hasn't been to the beach, your kid can read about a beach. That's a way for you to expose your child to the big wide world without even leaving your home.
We think of books and reading as the domain of, the parent, the teacher, the librarian, but also we've talked to pediatricians here in Wisconsin who are getting on board with this Reach Out and Read program. They're literally prescribing books for parents and kids. Do you see more attention out there to the importance of this, of reading at an early stage?
Yeah, isn't that fantastic that it's really becoming part of everyday life here now? People are realizing, you know, this is something that benefits all of us if our kids become readers. It benefits our whole society if we're raising people who can think critically, who have internal regulation, you know, who can set goals and reach them. And all of that follows from reading. So, you know, it's also, I'm sure the pediatricians are keeping this in mind too, it's also really good for building a bond with your baby, you know, especially for first-time parents or nervous parents or parents who might have other issues in their life. Sit down with your baby and a book, your toddler, your preschooler, and a book, and you suddenly can relax, and all of those troubles can kind of fall away while you read together.
I want to advance the age scale a little bit now, Maria. We heard from Jessica on Facebook who writes, "My parents read to me. I can't ever remember not having a book on hand. My favorite thing," Jessica writes, "about my childhood was going to the library. Reading takes me to places I'll never see, people I'll never meet, worlds that don't exist except in imagination." Jessica writes, "My world would be so small without books. I'm grateful to my parents for starting me on that path." So when, Maria, should we be getting that kid to the library and maybe that first library card?
You know, that first library card is such a landmark for kids. I think parents have to realize, you know, that's your child's first ID card. That's the first card that your child is going to have. It's such a great event. So, I think each library has a different system for this, but as soon as possible, get your child over to the library, get your own card. Also, you know, think about the excitement when you put a book on hold and your child gets an email and it's like, oh, the new Dog Man that you reserved is finally here. That's exciting. You know, so all of this is part of how you can create enjoyment and pleasure and a little bit of kind of excitement and this feeling of being advanced, you know, at this next stage of kid. You really want them to feel like they're entering into a more advanced way of life now that they're reading, and that comes along with stuff like, you know, having a library card and going to see their favorite author when their favorite author is visiting at the bookstore, getting their book signed. You know, that's a thrill. That's something that can really cement that relationship, you know, for life.
Let's talk about toddlers now. What are some books you recommend as the kids are really starting to pick up the words, being able to follow the stories?
Yeah, well, you know, our toddler recommendations, these are some of the most fun books that parents will probably recognize. You know, the Llama Llama books, Llama Llama Red Pajama. Those are fantastic. They have great rhymes. They have repetition. The art is bright, but also friendly. Those are great. You know, and then we have lots of the classics, you know, the Very Hungry Caterpillar, the Eric Carle. It's just one of those books that just always works. There's the holes they can put their fingers through. You know, we really like those lift the flap books for toddlers. But there's lots of new books too. You know, the old timey books tend to be not very diverse. You know, we have some new books coming out now that are much more diverse. There's different kids of different races, kids with different kinds of families. You know, every kid needs to find herself or himself in their books. And you can do that now. So, you know, what are some of the great books from your childhood? You know, they're probably still there, but supplement those with some of the fantastic newer books. You know, I love a book that just came out by Amy Schwartz called Busy Babies. It's just, you know, babies doing everyday stuff. It's super, super fun, and all the babies look really different.
Talking right now with Maria Russo. She's the children's books editor at the New York Times Book Review, co-author of the new book, How to Raise a Reader. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you or how did you encourage your kids to read? What have you done to try and instill a love of reading? And thinking back to your own childhood, however long ago that might have been, what do you remember about your first steps toward reading? Do you have a favorite, cherished childhood book from back then? Call in at 800-642-1234. Or if you have a question for our guest, call 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Maria Russo, co-author of the new book, How to Raise a Reader. We're talking about how parents can teach their kids to love reading. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What worked for you and your kids, or for your parents and you? Talk about the gateway books that you grew up with and maybe ones you shared with your own kids. Or do you have a question for our guest about your kid and maybe a good book to get them into reading or back into reading? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maria, before we go to our callers, let's talk about the teen years. Reading can seem like a chore, I know, for teenagers. They're doing a lot at school. That's a time when kids maybe fade away from reading. What can we do then?
Yeah, it's really important to remember it's never too late to become a reader or to pick reading back up. A lot of famous authors will tell us, you know, I really didn't read much until I was, you know, later in my teenage years or even as an adult. So the first thing you can do is not assume that your teenager is not interested in reading. Maybe it's just that that teenager hasn't found the right book. You know, a lot of kids in surveys will say, I just can't find books that interest me. So keep an eye on what are the books that connect with your teenager's interests. And I'll tell you, you might be surprised to hear this from New York Times editors, but we say if your child likes Fortnite, if your child has a favorite YouTube star, find a book connected to that. That could be a way in. I mean, it does seem like every YouTube star is publishing a book now, you know. And why is that, right? Because it turns out, like grown-ups, teenagers want a break from their screens. they're telling surveys that they need a break. Their life is full of screens, and a book is just it's kind of a weird, ironic thing that's happening, but books are now the escape. Books are the escape from screens. The screens dominate their lives. So find them books that they can hold in their hand, they can turn the pages. You know, it might not be a YA book, right? YA is the young adult books. Those are books written specifically for teenagers. They're written by great writers who understand how teenagers think, the teenage attention span. They have to capture their readers' attention really quickly, so they do tend to be thrilling and fast-paced and intense. But some teenagers are ready for adult books and are kind of bored. Maybe they're sick of reading about high school. High school is, you know, can really weigh on you. So, you know, my daughter just finished, who's 16, she came back from camp and she brought that book, Memoirs of a Geisha. You know, it was sort of a best-selling literary book from a couple of decades ago now, you know, and I think that it's teenagers like to feel that, you know, they're getting a view into the adult world sometimes, and let them, you know, so don't always be thinking only about books about other teenagers. They also sometimes want to read about maybe nonfiction, you know, lots of boys who don't read in those years. I think it's because they're nonfiction readers. You know, not everybody loves stories. They might just need nice nonfiction. All of the great nonfiction bestsellers now are available in young readers' versions. I mean, you've probably seen those around. Well, let me tell you, they are sometimes better than the grown-up version because they're shorter. They, you know, they cut out a lot of the excess, you know, so I highly recommend. I find myself reading those young readers' versions of, you know, the great books. You know, the Trevor Noah book that's on the bestseller list for adults right now, there's a young readers version that is shorter and just as good. You know, he cleaned it up a little bit, cleaned up the language a little bit, and there it is. So really keep your eye out for all kinds of books that your teenager might be interested in, and don't be judgy. You know, I read tons of junk growing up, what we call junk. It's okay. You know, comics are good. Graphic novels are good. Graphic novels are an art form, you know. So I really, really emphasize with parents, you know, graphic novels have changed. They're not They used to be sort of, everyone sort of looked down on them or felt like, oh, I don't want my kid reading too many of those. Well, now they're winning national book awards. Now people are realizing visual reading is reading. It's okay if some of the information comes in a picture. That doesn't lessen the seriousness of the book.
Let's bring on a caller now. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about Michael?
Well, two things, really. I mean, one is my childhood. I was a really voracious reader, and my parents would frequently take me to the library, and I'd end up running out of books to read before it was time to bring them all back. I was telling the screener I finished elementary school with 700 or so book reports.
Wow.
So definitely a big reader as a child, and have really kind of been trying to get back into recreational reading now as an adult. But then my daughter, who is 11, you know, she is also a pretty big reader. And it's funny, in between when I called initially and going on the air now, it's funny that the guest brings up graphic novels because that's one of her favorite things to consume. You don't read in that? Okay, she doesn't read them now. They're too easy.
Oh, she's there. Okay.
yeah, she's in the
Oh, then she just needs
back.
More advanced ones.
Yeah.
There's tons of, there's
well, yeah, well, we got,
at
we
every
got
level.
All right, Michael, thanks so much for calling and listening along with your daughter. It sounds like that's fantastic. Say hi for us. Yeah, so how about some recommendations? I bet a question you get all the time, and some people listening are probably interested. My kid finished Harry Potter books. What next?
Well, it's a great time for fantasy. If your child is a Harry Potter fan, that means that they're into fantasy. So there's all kinds of fantasy series out there that are even, you know, today, one thing about Harry Potter was that world was not very diverse. You know, some people can even complain about that. So there's lots of more diverse fantasy series out there where, you know, not everybody is the same, you know, white and straight person. So keep your eye out for books like, you know, the Nevermore books. These are great for the younger Harry Potter reader. You know, the Lockwood and Company. This is a great English series where there's a detective agency that's run by children and they investigate like ghostly things. You know, one that I love, a series that I love for slightly older kids because it can get really dark, is the Miss Peregrine's Peculiar Children. That was made into a movie, but the books are really special because they also have these really eerie vintage photographs in them. So really keep your mind open to all kinds of fantasy books that your kid might be interested in. And, you know, we also have a new series from Rick Riordan, who is the author of the Percy Jackson books that lots of middle grade kids are, you know, crazy for. They go through the several series based on Greek mythology. So if your child is interested in fantasy, they might be interested in other kinds of mythology books. And there's just incredible mythology coming from around the world now. We have Norse myths. We have myths from Africa. We have myths from the Maya culture in Latin America. All of these are, you know, Rick Riordan himself is publishing some of these in his own series. So keep in mind, if they love Harry Potter, they might be really interested in all kinds of mythological stories.
Let's bring on another caller now. John is with us in Fitchburg. John, hi.
Hey, I got a couple questions right here. Every night, I have an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 2-year-old. Every night, they want me to read books to them. So I'm just wondering, since I have a range of kids, should we do books with lots of pictures, books with just words or a combination? And then how fast, I guess, should I be reading to them? Should I read slow enough where the 8-year-old can follow along with the words, or is it okay to read a little bit faster?
Wow, any thoughts? That's a range, 2 up to 8, Maria.
That's challenging. You know, I have 3, and I have that kind of range, too, and it can be really hard. The thing to remember is that the 2-year-old is really benefiting from hearing the more advanced books, even if she or he isn't quite following. So you might pick the more advanced books at first and let your 2-year-old just kind of be in the room fiddling with their own board books while you read a book like, say, some of the Roald Dahl books, I think. That's a really great age to come at them with the real classic children's literature that has such great language, but there's also a lot of action and adventure that the middle child will kind of get drawn in by. So I think really realizing there's probably not going to be one book that is perfect for a 2-year-old and an 8-year-old, but you can kind of, you know, and certainly those big, beautiful illustrated books are always going to be good, because don't forget, your 8-year-old still needs illustrations, still needs something visual. You don't want to ever take away the pictures just because a child learned how to read. They still need books that support the reading with a break. You know, don't we all love a little break from a big chunk of text? You know, let you, so if you can find a book that is a, some of the great picture books, I think 8-year-olds, you know, will really, really still enjoy. You know, one thing I found when I was reading to my youngest, the older children would sometimes come in, sneak in, and just to be like, oh, I remember that book.
Nostalgia. You know, there.
They want to be, yeah, exactly. They love to think about, oh, when I was little. So yeah, I mean, you just have to kind of experiment and realize that just keeping all of it in the mix, and who, some people, sometimes one kid is in, one kid is out, but as long as they're all getting something, and don't forget, your older child can read to the younger one. That's a great thing about that age gap.
Thanks a lot for the call, John. Hope that helped. Meg from Montello emailed to say, when my children were young, they had 2 bedtimes. One if they just went to bed, another later one if they wanted to read for an hour. It really encouraged them to read. Maria, in our last few moments, that idea of structuring in that reading time with and for the kids.
Yeah, the caller is offering a really great tip for parents. Because remember, kids like to do anything that's associated with privilege and being older. So yeah, so structuring in time for reading that feels like, wow, I get to have an extended bedtime, that's a great idea. But you know, it's also nice to have reading time that's not around bedtime, because you don't want, some kids hate bedtime, they dread it, you know, they hate the end of the day, so you don't want to always have books associated with, you know, the final curtain of bedtime.
Maria, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. Great to be there.
That's Maria Russo, children's books editor at the New York Times Book Review. She's the co-author of the new book, How to Raise a Reader. There is still time for your stories, experiences, and maybe book suggestions for kids of all ages. Maybe ones that grown-ups like, too. You can share that on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll check out a Wisconsin band that mixes classical music with bluegrass. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Governor Evers has declared today as Suicide Prevention Day in Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll look at what we can do to help end the stigma surrounding mental illness and suicide. First, as far as musical genres go, you might think of classical and bluegrass as about as far apart as you can get. But hold on. The Wisconsin group Grammony, a group that combines the two styles, the 5-person ensemble, has won a bunch of awards, including multiple Classical Album of the Year and Classical Song of the Year awards from the Madison Area Music Association. Michael Bell is a composer of grassroots and classical music. He performs on mandolin with Grammony. He recently spoke with Central Time executive producer Judith Sears Poisson.
Where did the idea of mixing those two genres, classical music and bluegrass music, come from?
Well, we first came together for an Earth Day celebration with new compositions to celebrate Earth Day with our Nelson Institute here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I teach.
And when was that?
That was back in 2010. We've been playing for 9 years. And if you know anything about musical groups, then you know what great friends we clearly must be.
That you lasted that long.
And let me tell you the names of those good friends.
Please.
So there's Chris Wagoner. He is our fiddler or our violinist. Then there is Jen Claire Paulson. She's our violist. She also plays in the Madison Symphony Orchestra. There's Mary Gaines on cello. And there's Chris Powers on bluegrass guitar.
So classical and bluegrass, I feel like many people would think, wow, those are about as far apart as you can get. But do you see lines between the two?
Well, classical music has actually always drawn on grassroots traditions, though sometimes it's done it in a somewhat abstract way and the audience sometimes has gotten a little lost, perhaps particularly in 20th century music. And as well, grassroots traditions have drawn very strongly on classical harmony, a lot of the instruments used. So we thought we'd put the two together in what we call classgrass music.
Classgrass. I love that. And I feel like Lua's Dance from your album Dance of the Plants has really lovely elements of both classical and bluegrass. Can you tell us a little bit about that piece?
Well, that's a lovely piece that was composed by our first violist. We now have a second violist, Chauncey Lee. And it's a really cool tune because it has this wonderful lilt. It's in 7/8 time, which is not a rhythm that's used very much in classical music. And often folk traditions like that little extra hop that you get from it.
It's interesting because as I was preparing for this, I wrote about this piece, but then I was like, but is it a song? And you just used the word tune. And I feel like in some ways we label different types of music differently in how highbrow they sound. Like piece sounds classier, no pun intended, than song. Is that something you struggle with?
Well, we usually don't call them pieces. When we use the word song, we usually mean something with words. We do a few vocal pieces. There, you got me saying pieces, for lack of a better term. But usually we call it a tune.
Let's listen to a bit of Lua's Dance. Should in general be less strict about labeling music in terms of what genre it's supposed to fit into?
Well, I think people do want some expectations of what they're going to listen to, and there can be constraints with that, but there's also the opportunity to take that expectation and go someplace else with it.
Quite a bit of your music really serves as an embodiment of place. What is Wisconsin and Midwestern about Grammony?
Well, the Midwest, I like to think of, is a place where East and West meet face to face. And there are peoples from all over the world here, and we try to embody that in our music. We draw on heritages that we in the band more closely identify with, and then we also bring those into dialogue with other ones from our area.
Well, and it's interesting because you said that Grammony came out of a request to play for Earth Day, which is something that came out of Wisconsin with Gaylord Nelson.
Indeed, very good point. And our name comes from the Latin word for grasses, Graminae. But that sounded a little too highbrow, so we call it Grammony. And also, we wanted the sense of the Latin to reference the classical, and of course, grass to represent grass.
I really like the song Baraboo Hills. That's on the album Germinations, a bluegrass symphony in D.
It actually came to me, the tune came to me after my daughter went on a geology field trip to the Baraboo Hills, and she came back with two rocks that she really loved, a red phyllite, which she called Phyllis the Phyllite. She gave it a name. And then there was Ricky, the Baraboo quartzite. And so I just came up with this notion of a kind of a love story between these two rocks, but it's a billion-year-old love story.
Wow.
That's how old those hills are.
Time for lots of twists and turns in that love story. And I do think that's one of the elements of living in Wisconsin is that the Baraboo Hills are really a geologic miracle, and they're right in our backyard. Sometimes it's easy to overlook those things.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that we can do in music, particularly through the names we give to things, but also the music itself, is to remind people of things that they actually already knew.
Let's listen to a little bit of Baraboo Hills. Thank you. talking with Michael Bell. He is Chair and Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of Community and Environmental Sociology at UW-Madison. And he is also a prolific composer of grassroots and classical music. We are talking about his award-winning class grass band, Grammony. And we are talking about some of the music and this mix of classical and bluegrass. And Michael, how does instrumental music especially evoke such strong moods and ideas? I mean, in your work with Grammony, you have songs that draw on the environment, dragon boats, even fermentation.
Well, music is a form of emotional communication. It's the human equivalent of birdsong, the growl of the bear, the bark of the dog, the purr of the cat. There's a marvelous book you might enjoy someday, called The Singing Neanderthals, that talks about music as actually being the original form of human communication. And it's emotional, so it really strikes you very, very deeply. Now, with words, of course, you can paint a lot of that in, but also with the instruments, we can get a little of the growl of the bear, we can get the call of the bird, we can get the bark of the dog, and maybe even the purr of the cat on our instruments.
I have to say that your song, The Last Nanook, is very evocative and, you know, not surprising given your background in environmental sociology and the environment itself. This is a very poignant song. Let's listen to a little bit of that. So tell us what's going on there. I think it'll be easy for people to be able to draw the connections.
Yeah, well, you can hear the sadness of the bear there in the very beginning of the piece and at the ending of the piece. It's kind of making a lonely call out to other bears as it's sitting there on the iceberg. The piece was inspired by that. I don't know if you've seen that photograph of the polar bear that's on an iceberg, and there's water all around it, and it's kind of drifting away and wondering where to go next. So we actually tried to put the sound of the wail of the bear in the music.
I think the range of Grammony is clear, partly because you're mixing these two genres of bluegrass and classical music, but also in the variety of tones. I mean, that's a very different tone than some of the things that we heard earlier.
Yeah, so one of the things that we're able to do with instrumental music is both think about the melody, which is kind of the idea, and then also think about the texture we give it, which changes the mood. So with the same melody, if you give it a different texture, it actually can have a very different meaning. And so we love to think about all the different extensions of sounds that we can do with our instruments. So your normal, like, bluegrass band, you know the sound of the banjo you're going to get, and you're going to get a few ranges of sound of the fiddle or what have you that really defines that genre. And we're going to use that, but then going back to that business about expectations and, you know, the advantages and disadvantages of defining a genre, we can then take that and go someplace else and hopefully not lose the audience in the process because they've got the familiar that they can then understand as we take it someplace else.
And before we let you go, what do you see tackling next in the class grass genre?
Well, our most exciting project right now, we think, is a new piece we're writing about climate change. It's called Respiration, and it evokes the notion that what you breathe in, something else breathed out, and what I breathe in, something else breathes out, and what I breathe out, you're going to breathe in, and vice versa. But not just us as people, us as parts of an ecology, which is constantly breathing and connecting.
Sounds lovely. We'll look forward to hearing it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us, Michael.
My pleasure.
Michael Bell is a composer of grassroots and classical music. He performs on mandolin with the group Grammony. He talked to Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson about mixing genres of music and how classical and bluegrass can work together. Coming up, we'll take a look at some of the latest efforts to prevent suicide here in Wisconsin. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Wisconsin Department of Transportation announced a new multi-million-dollar grant program for local transportation projects in the state. We'll talk to DOT Secretary-designee Craig Thompson about the initiative. Now, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, one person dies by suicide every 9 hours in Wisconsin. Governor Evers has declared September Suicide Prevention Month and today Suicide Prevention Day in the state. In a statement, Evers said, quote, "We have to get serious about destigmatizing mental health and suicide and start investing in much-needed mental health resources, especially for our kids at school and our farmers who are facing unprecedented economic challenges. If you or someone you know may be contemplating suicide, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline for free confidential help. That number is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. You can also text HOPELINE 741-741. Mary Kay Battagli is Executive Director of NAMI Wisconsin. NAMI stands for National Alliance on Mental Illness. Mary Kay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
Can you talk about the scope of the problem of suicide here in Wisconsin?
Yes. In Wisconsin, we have seen an uptick in suicides, and especially in our rural communities, as well as our veterans. And it is of concern for our state how many suicides per year are happening in our state.
Talk about the stigma surrounding suicide. The governor in that statement mentioned destigmatizing both mental illness and I think people want to say, hey, suicide is something that we actually can talk about. We don't have to have this stigma associated with the topic and avoid it altogether.
Right. So one of the things that we see, especially in the rural communities, is just the access to care, but also the stigma. So getting people to open up and say that they need the help is one of the more difficult things because it seems a weakness or something that perhaps that it's because of a lack of strength. People don't, when you say, oh my gosh, I'm having a heart attack or my heart hurts and you go to the hospital, there's no hesitation for you to go get help. You don't think people will think you're weak because your heart is not functioning. And we would like for us to get to the point where when you're very depressed or have high anxiety, but or other mental illnesses, that you seek help just like you would for any other physical illness. It is something that's going on in your brain and you should access care. But we find people avoid getting help because of the stigma related to it. And it affects you in your jobs. It affects you at school. It affects you in your relationships. And people tend to avoid getting help. Therefore, the stigma is adding to the problem. And we need to figure out a way, and we do at NAMI, we've worked on several programs where we have programs where we go out in the community and give talks. It's mostly people living with a mental illness that go out and tell their experience of what the stigma, how it kept them from getting help earlier. And lots of statistics show the earlier you get help, the better the outcome, and the quicker you get better, and the better the recovery is quicker. So if we can get people to start seeking help earlier, we can have a better outcome. And that the way we get them to do that is to decrease the stigma of getting help.
What are some of the biggest misconceptions you see out there when it comes to how we talk about suicide?
That if you have a family member or friend that you're suspicious may be suicidal. One of the things that is a misconception is that you shouldn't talk about it because you might suddenly have them attempt a suicide.
You might give them the idea.
Right. And if someone is suicidal, they've already had the idea. You are not going to give them the idea. And in fact, what research shows is they're relieved if you just say, are you thinking about harming yourself? You can be even more direct and just say, are you thinking of taking your own life? And what they have discovered is that people that are suicidal will frequently open up and feel cared for and taken care of, and it reduces the number of suicides. So don't be afraid. That's one of the steps of questioning. There's a training throughout the state that many people can take. It's called a QPR training. It's an hour training. We have them here in Madison, and they're all over the state, and it just takes you through the steps. And the Q is question, you know, do you feel suicidal? And if that answer is yes, then you move forward and you can help them. But if you never ask the question, then you can't help.
Talking to Mary Kay Battaglia from NAMI, Wisconsin. It's Suicide Prevention Day here in the state and around the world. Mary Kay, there's a stereotype maybe of us here in the Midwest. We want to be self-sufficient and we don't want to pry. Do those two practices get in the way of talking about suicide?
They do. They do. And we are self-sufficient, but being self-sufficient, it is a wise decision to take care of yourself. The longer you delay getting care or help, the more it costs you in time away from work and as well as time of being productive. And so, yes, I grew up in a farm community and a very tough farm community, and I understand and relate to that. But if you can change the conversation and discuss how wise it is to seek help and seek care, I think it would have a much better, it will, I don't think it would, have a much better outcome, and you would get help quicker, and then you would be in recovery quicker and back to being the productive Midwesterners that we are.
When it comes to suicide prevention and mental health treatment, where do we need more resources here in the state?
Oh, we need more resources everywhere, but specifically our rural communities. There are many counties in this state that have no mental health care provider at all, not just a psychiatrist, but any type of health care provider, and they have to travel distance to seek that. That's why having these the Hope line, text line, and suicide lines are really an excellent avenue for them. We're working with other organizations to try to see if we can get telemedicine into those areas so that therapy would be available. But still, it's money that needs to be spent on things such as that. Having the healthcare providers be able to do that as well, because they have very busy practices. But there is nationwide, there's a high demand right now for more psychiatrists. But in our rural communities, it's even more significant.
I think it was on your national organization's page. Another misconception can be that if you're suicidal now, you always will be. Whereas, in fact, for many people, it's an acute crisis. It might be something that if you get through that week, that couple of weeks, you may not be there again.
Right. So what we find is there are people that have suicide ideation where they think about it a lot over a time. That is the rare person. It is mostly an acute event, a loss of a relationship, a loss of a job, not feeling well. You can have significant depression. And what we find is recovery is definitely available and out there. So it is not something that you will always live with. It is something that if you seek help and get care that you can get through and live. And we, in the NAMI world, we call it living in recovery.
In our last minute or so, over time, are we getting better at least at talking about suicide and acknowledging it as a problem that needs to be tackled?
I think so. I think like many things, our younger generation is where the wave is, right? We have a program called Raise Your Voice, and it's a mental health awareness club that we're spreading throughout the state in the high schools. And it's student run, and they have their own organization, and they're really talking more about it on campus here at UW and at Oshkosh and at Stevens Point. We have a NAMI on campus group. I think the conversation is becoming more common with our youth. I think it's one of those things that hopefully in newer generations, if we continue to have those conversations with our youth in the high schools and lower, that maybe the conversation will be different where they'll seek care when they need it.
Mary Kay, thanks so much for joining us today.
I really appreciate getting the word out. Thank you so much.
Mary Kay Battaglia is executive director of NAMI Wisconsin. We talked to her about suicide prevention efforts here in the state. It's National Suicide Prevention Month, and Governor Evers has declared today Suicide Prevention Day in the state. For more discussion on suicide prevention, tune into The Morning Show Thursday at 6:30. Kate Archer Kent and her guest will talk about risk factors, more suicide myths, language, and more. Again, that's Thursday morning at 6:30. And again, if someone or you know or you are struggling with suicidal thoughts or emotional distress, you can get free confidential help on the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's 800-273-8255, 800-273-8255, or text HOPELINE to 741-741. How does this sound? An infinite conveyor belt of cheese ready to be picked up and eaten by you. Pretty good, right? Well, it exists, but don't get too excited right now. A, you have to pay for it, and two, it's in London, England. As reported by CNN, a new wine and cheese restaurant in London called Pick and Cheese features a 40-meter-long conveyor belt. My crude approximation, that's about 40 yards, that circulates cheese and other foods around. Customers pick up a plate of cheese. The plates are color-coded to show the cost of each item. The restaurant has over 24 cheeses. These are all made in the UK, including Red Leicester, Yorkshire Pecorino, and Cornish Gouda. I've seen sushi places around the country with that model, except the food is on little sushi boats that float around on water. That's pretty cool. So anyway, with this cheese conveyor, why is Wisconsin not on the cutting edge of this? We can come up with 2, 4, 6 dozen cheeses to have going around a conveyor belt or cheese boats. I would be okay with cheese boats. So cheese entrepreneurs, get on this. I'll be among your first customers. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.